I'm about to confess something with the hope that the statute of limitations has expired, but I still think there are at least 12 of you who might hate me for admitting this. I have to get it off my chest because I've always felt terribly guilty about it. So, here it goes. This happened about 13 or 14 years ago. I was not quite a playwright yet, but I was starting to get the sense that I was not really an actor anymore, and I started to think about giving playwriting a shot. I dabbled in writing a couple short pieces, and I started to read plays. I never really read a play if I wasn't acting in it, so I knew I had a lot of work to do to get an idea of what a new play looked like and to get a feel for the plays out in the world trying to get produced. I ended up volunteering to be a first-round reader for a well-respected theater company that had an annual playwriting award they gave out. I thought this would be a good move for me. Not only would I get to read a bunch of new plays, but I would also be starting to develop a relationship with a well-respected theater. In retrospect, this was a terrible idea. My life was spread incredibly thin. I was helping to run a theater company, acting in a play, and working a lot of hours as a consultant for a major company. But I was determined to devote as much of myself to theater as I possibly could, regardless of the stupid amount of hours I worked in my day job. Anyway, this well-respected theater company gave me a stack of 12 plays, and I brought them home, went to rehearsal, then traveled out of town for my job the next day, then traveled back, then rehearsal again, and so on. And the following weekend, I moved to a new apartment. Weeks go by. Then, a couple months. My point of contact at this well-respected theater reached out to ask me for my reader reports because they were way past due. Reader reports? What reader reports? Oh, shit. Those plays. What did I do with those plays? I remember driving to the theater, being handed them in a paper bag, then putting them down in my old apartment? Oh my god, they're gone. I had 12 plays to read, read none of them, lost all of them, and forgot they even existed. 12 playwrights wrote new plays and sent them to this theater with hopes and dreams, and I promptly squashed them. The point of contact at this well-respected theater could not believe what I told them, and I couldn't blame them. What kind of complete jackass would do such a thing? The answer is, dear listener, this kind of jackass. The Brian James Polak kind of jackass. Ultimately, I confess not to be forgiven, but to acknowledge my stupidity so that perhaps I can stop thinking about it every time I see a stack of plays sitting on the floor. If you were one of those 12, listen, I did you wrong, and I've been trying to make it right ever since. I hope you're still writing plays. Welcome to the Subtext Podcast. My name is Brian James Polak. I am a playwright and I am the host. If you're a first-time listener, welcome aboard. This is a monthly playwright conversation podcast, so if you're into learning about some awesome writers working today, you should stick around. You can subscribe wherever podcasts can be found. And if you like the subtext, go ahead and rate and review the show to help us get into the ears of like-minded peoples. This month, I am sharing with you a conversation with Adam Simkowitz that I recorded back in July. If you don't know Adam, you should. He's the OG playwright interviewer with over 1,000 of them on his blog. He's a great and prolific writer, and a big reason why I've been doing the subtext for the past 4 years plus. We recorded this conversation in Connecticut, where Adam lives with his wife, Kristen Palmer, another excellent playwright I hope to get on the subtext one of these days, and their son Wallace, who makes a brief cameo about halfway through our chat. You were, when I started to do this, you were one of the first people I wanted to talk to.
Thanks.
And here's why. As a lot of people know, this started back in Los Angeles, and I was doing this for LA Stage Alliance. And when I started it, before the podcast was even a thought, LA Stage Alliance was launching a new website, and they wanted to create content for it. So they reached out to me because I was, you know, in the LA theater community and was working at a theater and knew a lot of playwrights. And they said, hey, do you want to do something for our website? And I was like, oh, sure. What did you have in mind? And they're like, well, we're thinking like a playwright interview thing like Adam Simkowitz does. And I said, well, Adam already does that well. What would I do? Like, I don't want to do that because he's already doing that. And they said, Danny Oliver from LA Stage Alliance said, well, what about a podcast? And I was like, oh, well, that's cool. I'm into that. Although I don't know how to do any of that stuff, but I could absolutely do a podcast. That sounds really interesting because I don't know of another podcast that exists where it's like two playwrights just talking it out. And so when we established that, found a name and then started recording them, I was like, well, now I have to get Adam. And, that's cool. You know, you live on the East Coast. I lived at the time on the West Coast. But you were always like that person in my mind. I was like, I'll eventually get to Adam. Right. And then I moved to Chicago and the whole thing started with LA Stage Alliance. So I actually have a lot more freedom now because I travel. I have the recording equipment of my own and I travel. And I'm glad that this is happening now, finally.
It's so good. Thanks for having me. I keep nodding while you're talking.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah, no. He knows.
Yeah.
No one else will know.
Yeah. I should include a web video component to this live stream.
Or just a bunch of parentheticals.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we did say before that, you know, the two of us together will be a lot of silence.
Right. To New England.
Yeah.
Humans.
Did you grow up in New England?
Yeah, I grew up like where we are right now. I grew up around 15 minutes away. This was my late grandmother's house that we're in right now.
Oh yeah.
And so I was here like regularly.
Yeah.
And now I live here.
We're in Colchester, right?
We're in East Haddam, but
East
it's
Haddam.
Right next
okay.
to Colchester.
And Colchester is your hometown.
2 minutes that way. Colchester, yeah.
Yeah, okay. When did you move into this house?
So Kristen was 6 months pregnant and had just got an artistic director job at Oddfellows, which is in Middletown here. Mm-hmm. And that was about 6 years ago. And Wallace is about, it's more than 6 years ago, but like around that, yeah.
And where were you living at the time?
We were living in Brooklyn. And Kristen was going to Hunter, studying with Tina Howe. And so we were in Brooklyn for like two or three years. And then before that, I had that crazy TV job and I was in Atlanta for 5 months. And we were here for maybe a year and a half at one point. I originally moved to New York in 2001 and was there until 2000, and I think we moved to Minneapolis for Kristen's Jerome in 2008, right after we got married.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you followed all that.
We're in basically central Connecticut, right?
Yeah, we're kind of in it's all a bunch of small towns here,
and we're sort of outside the part of the divide of Connecticut where one side roots for New England teams and the other side roots for New York teams.
Right. Everybody here.
We're on the New England side.
Yeah.
Are we?
It could go either way. There are Yankee fans here and there are Red Sox fans.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
And within my family, that's true.
Right. There's that cultural divide.
Yeah.
Was New York, I know for people from, you know, Southern Connecticut, like New York is a very, very accessible city growing up.
We did not go to New York very much. Although I go there every week now, for my job, and it's not that hard. It takes a while, as you know, because you just came from there.
Yeah.
But it's not that far away. But I feel like if we were going to a city, usually it was Boston. For some reason.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah. So growing up, New York wasn't like.
New York was not a place to go regularly.
Yeah.
But like now it seems like, why wasn't it? I don't know.
Right. Yeah. Because your parents.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
Was your family artistically inclined or into theater or anything?
No. I mean, I was in plays in high school, and we would go, like there were like school groups to go see like plays at Hartford Stage and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really into theater. But I mean, it made me so nervous. Like I loved it, but it made me so nervous. And it wasn't what I really wanted to
do. Being on the stage made you nervous?
Being on the stage.
Yeah.
But you know, weirdly, and this is still true, like it feels like when I'm sitting in the audience of my play, it feels like I'm more on stage than if I was actually on stage.
Oh yeah.
Doing someone else's play. Like it I feel like I'm completely up there. And sometimes like with talkbacks afterwards, I'm like, oh God, people want me to talk about it more. Like I feel like I've just been talking for 90 minutes.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I've never heard anybody articulate it that way. Although I've thought about with my own work, there are oftentimes specific characters that are me. Mm-hmm. Like I'm speaking through this one character, and then sometimes I'm split amongst all of them. So yeah. I guess in those moments, I do feel like I've just never thought about it. I do feel like I am talking directly.
I feel like it's all from my head, and so. Yeah, I don't know. I don't really write that way anymore, in which there's like the character that's the me character.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think if that's actually true now that I just said that out loud. But like I used to write a lot more that way.
Mm-hmm.
But now, yeah, I don't know. It does feel like I'm there constantly when mm-hmm. I'm and I hate actually physically being in front of people.
Yeah.
I just feel exposed and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah. My big struggle, I acted a little bit, in my 20s, and I never, ever felt comfortable on stage. I learned that my comfort is in direct relation to the expectation of what I'm going to say. So if there is no expectation, if I don't have a script I need to follow,
mm-hmm.
if it is a talk back where whatever happens,
yeah.
I'm totally fine. But if I have to deliver a speech,
God.
Get it. Don't ever don't ever ask me to do that.
Right. Yeah, I don't want to do that.
I had to do a roast once.
Really?
And I had to roast somebody. And I'm not a joke writer, you know, but I watched a bunch of roasts. And I had 5 minutes or something that I had to do, and it was like my hardest writing assignment.
How'd it go?
I don't think it went well overall, but it started strong, and I think maybe that's all you really need, because they all end with something sweet, you know, really, I love you, Adam. So this is congratulations or whatever.
I was just kidding about that all that terrible thing.
So I had said. One, I had two strong openers, and then like a dozen sort of mediocre, groan worthy jokes, and then it ends nicely. So you know, that's pretty much how it went. But it took me 3 or 4 days just to find two jokes that would really work. And they were actually they were self-deprecating jokes about me, if I can remember correctly. But this is like 10 years ago.
You didn't even really roast. You roasted yourself.
When I went into roasting the other person, that's when I failed. Because I feel terrible about even pretending to say nasty things about a person I like. You know? Like, I genuinely like them.
That's not a terrible thing. Thing to be. That sounds like
I guess it's much healthier than emotionally, I guess, than what a lot of those comics have to go through. I watch these roasts a lot though, and they are I don't know, these performers seem to love what they get out of it. And I guess if you're in it, you know what to expect, so.
And they kind of roast everyone in the room, which I kind of find fascinating. It's like they have like I assume that they have like a team of writers, and it's like them and like their like whoever their go-to people are who are like writing jokes for them. And
right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's such a weird thing. Because it's also like they're doing a like a mini set.
Right, yeah.
And so they're like talking about people in the room and trying to like make fun of everybody, but they're also they also have like their mini set that they're doing. And
right.
So it's like really just like an opportunity for them to get exposure and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm glad playwrights don't have to do that.
Yeah, well, I guess in some way we do, but it's just everything.
10-minute plays. I guess.
Yeah, yeah, that's where it is. Speaking of which, 10-minute plays is where I started as a writer. So I wasn't when I started writing, I was already out of undergrad, and I was just sort of on my own trying to find my way. And the 10-minute play was kind of like my access point where I could figure out how to do that, and I could learn the craft that way.
Yeah.
How did you begin?
So when I was in college, my first year, I was like, no, I'm not acting anymore. I'm done acting.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second year, I decided I missed it and was going to start doing it again. And I was in, I don't remember, a couple plays at least that year. And then that summer, I decided I was going to write a play. And so I like wrote... I must have written some little thing. I know I wrote like some little things in high school and stuff, but like basically I wrote like my first like what I consider a play. And it was heavily influenced by Night Mother, and it was heavily mm-hmm. influenced by Marriage of Bette and Boo. And it was kind of like it was a comedy about suicide mm-hmm. is what it was.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, that wasn't the first one, but like that was like 2 summers after that or something. But basically I started writing plays and then I never really stopped, and I would write one every summer, and then I just started writing them all the time, and then that's kind of what I do now. So it's been like, I mean, that was like 97 or something, so it's been like 22 years.
So was there a moment where you were, after a while, you just had this realization that I guess I'm a playwright now?
I mean, from undergrad, I applied to grad schools for playwriting. I was like, oh, okay, I think I want to do this.
Yeah.
And I was an English major. Like, I originally had chosen the school because I thought I wanted to be an engineer.
Right.
Of some sort. But like the end of high school, I was doing calculus and it was so hard, and I was like, I don't ever want to do this again.
Right.
Like, this is not who I am.
Yeah.
And so I was like an English major at a school that like an English major wasn't really.
What was the school?
UMass, the one in North Dartmouth.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I whenever I say UMass Dartmouth, people are like, oh, Dartmouth. And I'm
right.
like, no,
yeah.
It's UMass. All right. Forget it. So I say it that way now.
Right.
Just
yeah.
to make it less confusing. So the first year I applied to like, I think I just applied to NYU cause I was like, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to live in New York.
Yeah.
And then I didn't get in. And then I applied again the next year to a few places and I got into Columbia. I graduated in 99 and I went to Columbia starting in 2001. Like the second day of class was September 11th. Which was messed up. Yeah.
So you're like...
But there was already like an amazing community there because we'd had like a summer like collaboration weekend with Ann Bogart and everything.
Yeah.
So it was like a bunch of people in a room just crying.
And you were brand new to the city.
Yeah. Like pretty... Like I think I'd probably been there like a couple of months or so at that point.
But
it was... Yeah, no, it was a crazy time to be like, this is what New York is.
Oh, wow. How did you find out?
So I was working for this artist. I was packing up his art. Like, I was, like, in the shipping department of this, like, tiny little company in New Rochelle, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I just, like, it was, like, on the news. It was, I mean, was there, like, a TV on? I'm not sure. I think my girlfriend at the time called me and was like, this thing happened.
Yeah.
And I was supposed to go into the city later that day to go to class. And like all the trains were shut down and nobody was going anywhere.
Yeah.
And at first, like, I didn't really realize. I was like, well, that's messed up. Like, this thing happened. But like, everyone's kind of freaking out. And then and then the second plane hit, and yeah. Everyone was like, "Okay, we're all going home." They were like afraid there was going to be looting for some reason.
I remember,
And like that is not a thing that happened that day at all. But it was kind of crazy.
I was working in a high rise building in downtown Boston at the time, so I had I had this office job, and I remember it was because it was. First thing in the morning when it happened.
Yeah.
I was in the habit at that time of checking my email in the morning and then at the end of the day and had virtually no kind of like internet interaction throughout the day. Like,
right.
And
right.
This event really changed the way I use the internet permanently. So that day, like I was checking the news and I remember I was on CNN.com. And it had just happened, and everyone thought it was a small prop plane.
Yeah.
Everyone outside the city.
Everyone was like, oh, there's, like, some kind of accident. Yeah. Some stupid person, like, accidentally, like, smashed their plane into the...
Yeah.
Yeah. But, like, it was such a big deal that, like, you know, I was getting a call about it.
Right,
and I was like, yeah, that's crazy. Because everyone was like, that's crazy. And then they're like, ah, this is really crazy. It happened again.
I got a call from a friend who worked in the New York office of the company I was working for, and they were in Chelsea, and they were like 8th Avenue and 15th Street.
Yeah.
And south of them, there weren't tall buildings at the time, so they could see all the way down. And the first one hit, and she called to check in with us because she had moved to the New York office from the Boston office, so we were still friendly. And she said, "You see what happened? It's crazy." And I'm like, "Yeah, like what's going on?" And she's like, "Oh, we don't actually really know." Like there was like that panic hadn't set in yet because nobody had any of that information.
Thought, like we're under attack. Like people thought like some stupid person accidentally crashed a plane into a building.
Yeah. And then she hung up the phone and then a moment after she was like, "Well, I just wanted to check in with you all," and she hung up the phone and a minute later the second one.
Yeah.
Hit and we all got evacuated from all of our buildings and which is crazy to think, you know. I imagine like everybody that worked in a tall building,
everybody
all over the country, was like GTFO now.
And all the trains were shut down, and I had just gotten my first cell phone, so like that's the only reason that I even got a phone call.
Yeah,
you know. But like everyone in my office was like, "Oh, this crazy thing just happened," like it was like the thing everyone was talking about. And then it was like, this is terrorism. We're all leaving for the day. We're going to shut down this, like, tiny company.
And where were you living at the time?
I was living in New Rochelle, and so I just walked home.
Yeah.
Or I had a car at the time, but yeah, I probably just walked home.
Yeah.
Which was not that far away.
And when was the next time you actually came back to the city, to campus?
Like the day after.
Yeah.
And my girlfriend at the time didn't want me to go. And I was like, it's fine. I'm going to go. I'm going to the city. And, you know, like people who like live nearby had to evacuate the area.
Right.
You know, they had like, there was like black smoke over everything. It was like I was like not living actually in the city.
Right.
And so in a weird way, like I was, yeah.
But your relationship to the city must have been formed around this event.
Well, I also feel like because that's kind of the first thing, one of the first things that happened when I moved to the city, like I have a very different idea about, like I'm kind of less afraid than people who I think moved to the city after that.
Yeah.
Like because I was actually there or nearby, like I was there the next day, basically. Mm-hmm. I was 30 minutes outside the city. But like there, like living there, I think that it seemed much more terrifying from far away.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like later on when we had the power outage that the whole everything shut down, like everyone was just like, "Oh, okay, we kind of," and everyone was so nice afterwards. Right after September 11th, like there was like a big kind of like, we're all in this together. Like it was, I've never seen New York like that before, but everyone was like trying super hard to be nice to everyone else, which was like a weird thing of us all kind of coming together.
Yeah. Yeah, because that reputation that New Yorkers have, sort of like, get out of my way, give me that thing.
Which I don't really think is accurate. I mean, when people say that, it's because most of the time people are like not following the social rules of New York.
Yeah.
Which is like, you don't stop in the middle of the sidewalk during rush hour. You don't stop in the middle of the stairs. You don't stand in front of the doors when the doors are opening on the subway. It's like there's a bunch of things that if you don't know, that people are going to be really rude to you in New York.
Yeah.
But like most people, most of the time are actually really helpful and nice. And there's, you know, there's a bunch of crazy people or people that have had like a really bad day who want to yell at someone.
Yeah.
But like, that's not, you know, like most of my experiences are positive with strangers in New York.
I experienced, I felt like a New Yorker for a moment yesterday because I walked across the Brooklyn Bridge to Brooklyn.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah. And,
we did that after we got married.
And there were so many tourists, and I'm like, this is really frustrating. Everyone's walking three or four abreast.
Yeah.
And you have and the bikers are coming on the other lane, and, and you just like, I'm on my way somewhere. Please, I'm not here to take selfies. This is transportation for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I caught myself, and I was just like, that's really funny. It's like I live here. I cared that much about getting where I was going quickly.
It's so crowded. I mean, especially during rush hour, like the subway at rush hour is awful. And if there's like one subway problem, which there's subway problems constantly these days, if there's like one subway problem, then it's just completely packed and everyone is miserable and everything's awful.
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, I'm glad that I'm not there all the time anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
When you so when you started grad school, when you're at Columbia and this, you know, this major event happens, but a status quo hadn't been established for you yet because you were so new, like what the day-to-day life was of being here and living in this place and going to grad school. Did it feel like it took a while for that to happen? Just sort of like what life for you is like in this place?
I mean, we already all knew each other, and we'd already, you know, we already did like this thing called Collaboration Weekend, where we write a short play and put it up. And so like, I knew everyone's name, and like, we all kind of, like the playwrights had hung out a couple times. So we already knew each other.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember anything like that. I feel like it was a thing that bonded us more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a crazy once-in-a-lifetime thing.
How long did it take you to feel sort of grounded when you were in school?
I don't know.
Did you ever?
A long time ago
at
this point. Like, it's like, I don't know. And actually, almost all the plays that I wrote at Columbia were not very good, I don't think. I was still very much learning how to write a play. And I also feel like the method that Eduardo used was not really the method that was helpful for me. I mean, I still kind of fall back on some of those tools. So in that way, it was helpful, but it was like about building some tool sets and building writing exercises and things more than, I'm going to disagree with myself because I think what it was helpful for was getting into the subconscious, getting into like, what do you care about? What do you actually want to write about?
Mm-hmm.
And I think for that purpose, it was helpful in terms of actually using it to write it didn't come out me writing the kind of plays that I wanted to yet, but it did get at the things that I was interested in and the things that I wanted to write about.
Now, is it something that's sort of like built in that just happens automatically to you now, or subconsciously?
I mean, I feel like it's a lot easier to get to that. It was almost all Marie Irene Fornes writing exercises.
Mm-hmm.
And both Kelly Stewart and Eduardo Machado were both doing different versions of that.
Right.
And the purpose of it was to like get into like your gut and like what you're like, whatever you're like was going on in you right now, like kind of get that out.
Right.
I don't know if they would say it that way, but in my mind, that's what it was for.
Yeah.
And I do feel like it's a lot easier to do that now without, like, you know, trying to do a writing exercise for like an hour or something.
Well, I guess like the Paula Vogel Bake Off does a very similar thing. It's about
in a different way. It does a similar thing.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. It's about accessing that, going to that place where,
yeah,
you're just writing. You're not censoring. You're just letting everything come out naturally.
Yeah, and we were all supposed to be like, we weren't supposed to have computers in the room. We were all just supposed to be writing on a pad and paper.
Mm-hmm.
Which actually, like, when I get stuck, if I pull out a pad and try to do it that way, like, it works a lot better than on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just that's a reality. Honestly, that's true for almost everybody, I think.
Yeah.
Like, it connects to a different part of your brain. I read about it somewhere once upon a time. I don't know if Eduardo read that, but, like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
For me, it's verbally talking it out.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. I think that I do that sometimes without knowing I'm doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it is about shutting off, like closing the computer, like I can't talk it out at a computer. It's being away from a computer, car.
Do you go for a walk?
Yeah, it'll be like on a walk. Yeah. It'll be breaking whatever location I'm in.
Yeah.
Driving in a car, walking somewhere, riding a train, doing any of these other activities. I can't talk on a train, but I talk a lot when I walk, and I'll record voice memos. And when I drive,
I've never done that.
When I drive, I'll hit record.
Yeah.
If a thought comes to me, and you know, one of those, I'm sure this happens to you, it happens to a lot of us. You have an idea or a solution for a writing problem, and you say, okay, I'll remember that.
Maybe.
And you don't. Yeah. So I've taken to recording it verbally.
I send myself an email.
Yeah.
I don't like to talk.
Mm-hmm.
I don't talk to Siri. I have shut her off because I don't want to do that. My mom talks to her all the time.
I never talk to Siri. Yeah. I get irritated with Siri when I hit my phone incorrectly. And Siri pops up. I'm like, I didn't invite you in here.
Yeah, no, I haven't. I don't allow her to talk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's probably for the best. She'll take over one day.
There's a thing. You can set it up so that she never talks.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I should look into that because I get irritated every time I hold my thumb too long onto the phone. And
what it's awful.
She's like, what do you want? I'm like, nothing.
And I don't like to, if I don't ever have to talk on the phone, I'd be completely happy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, if I could do everything over email, that would be awesome.
Right. do you recall that play where you felt like it was coming together for you? Like, you were figuring out who you were as a writer?
But I mean, my thesis at Columbia was Nerve. Which was like in the third year, we weren't having like regular classes. We had playwriting like once or twice a week or something, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like a part timey. In the third year is like a part time thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the play that I wrote that third year.
Mm.
And so I feel like that was more of the kind of thing that I wanted to write than anything that I'd written. The 2.5 years before that or whatever.
Yeah. How would you define that though? It being the thing you want to write more than other things. What was it about it?
I mean, it's my stuff. It's Marcia Norman calls it my stuff, your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Which my stuff is all love and relationships and all what is love? What is that all about? And
mm-hmm.
why are we doing this? And like, that's really all my plays are about that in some ways, or at least the best ones are.
Mm-hmm.
The play that I wrote after that, was Pretty Theft. And that one, kind of was expanded outwards and kind of has like a lot of theatricality that I hadn't played with before. Like Nerve has a little bit of like, it has some dance in it.
Right.
But Pretty Theft has like a lot of dance and like wrenches falling from the ceiling. And like there's, it's, yeah, it's, uh, it's got like multiple storylines going on and like a lot of like it's expansive in a different way. And I feel like that play got me a lot of attention, and that play got me into Juilliard.
Mm-hmm.
So that was like a huge one too. And then, I mean, more recently, I think Kodachrome has been my, feels like a big step too.
I want to talk about Kodachrome.
Oh, okay.
Because the last time I saw you in person, you probably wouldn't remember this, but we were in Portland.
I remember. We're in Portland.
And I was with the person I was with at the time, and I just stepped out of the bookstore.
Yeah.
And I had just bought a copy of Thornton Wilder's Our Town. Like an old copy of it. Because I had just that week started to ruminate on my next play.
Mm-hmm.
I had only verbalized it to them. I hadn't said it to anybody else. And then my partner, my ex. And then we bumped into you, and it was great to see you.
Did I know that you were in town, or did I just like actually bump into you on the street?
I think we bumped into each other.
That happened. That's the second, like it's happened twice in Portland that I just like randomly
run
into someone.
Because you were there for the festival.
Jaw, which was that play, which was called Colchester at the time.
Right. Yeah. Right. And I so bumped into you and we started talking, and I said, "Oh, what's your play about?"
Yeah.
Then you described what Colchester was about, and you said, "Oh, it's kind of an Our Town thing."
It's not really. Like, I wrote it not having read Our Town in a really long time. Mm-hmm. I read Our Town afterwards because everyone kept saying, "Oh, this is like an Our Town play."
Yeah.
And I describe it that way because people know what Our Town is.
Yeah.
But it's actually kind of an anti Our Town play. Like, Our Town is really. Like, it's actually a lot more, what's the word? It's a lot more, like, pro-relationship than Our Town.
Yeah.
Like, Our Town is really about, like, marriage is awful. we all go to war because we have to.
Right.
Everything is miserable. And nobody seems to notice that. I mean, I love it. It's an amazing play, but it's not at all like what my play is, which is more like a memory, like letting go and moving on with your life and finding love again after having lost love.
Well, I hadn't read your play yet, and you evoked Our Town in describing
right.
And I was like immediately grief stricken because I said, Adam's doing this. How, like, and I looked at the person I was with, and I was like, please do not say that Brian is also working on, because I was specifically leaning into Our Town with deep intention. and I was like, I was immediately embarrassed and didn't want it to be mentioned. and I almost didn't do it. So I ended up not writing it until that was what, July? It was like the summer.
It was 2015.
It was the summertime.
In the summer, yeah.
So I didn't write it until the February of the following year.
Oh, wow.
Because I spent a few months not really sure I was going to do it anymore. And then I mature, you know, the mature side of me kicked in and said, there's 0% chance that you're going to write anything even close to what Adam writes, and you need to write this. So write it.
It's really, really, even the people that we write like, we don't really write like them. You
right.
know? I mean, that's another thing that I got from Eduardo Machado is like, he's like, don't worry about being original. Like, your stuff, like, you're going to write what you write. And because you're writing it and you're here right now, no one else is writing it. And if you write from who you are, that's like, it's not.
Yeah. And you know what? I think if I was younger when this moment happened, it would have sent me on a totally different trajectory.
Yeah.
Because I would have been too focused on being me and being an individual and doing my own thing.
Right.
So for me, writing, like you mentioned how Colchester, now called Kodachrome, was a play that was sort of like a step for you.
Yeah.
My version is the same thing for me. It changed things for me, and it's the first play that's getting some recognition. And
it's been on my pile forever.
I almost
to read it.
It almost didn't happen.
Because I know Keen.
Yeah.
But you're having two productions coming.
Two productions,
right?
Of it, yeah, yeah.
At the same time, is it rolling or is one over premiere?
Co-world
that's
premiere.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
That's really exciting.
But anyway, that's for my episode of the podcast when I interview myself.
It's going to be a weird episode.
Yeah. Talk about silence. So much silence. Or it'll just be...
What if it's just you like refusing to answer any of your own questions? Be like, I don't want to talk about that. I can't believe you brought this up. It's like, who told you that?
And then just say, can you edit that out? Can you edit that out? But so, we're jumping around a little bit, but Kodachrome came up and you mentioned it as a play that really changed something for you. So what was it?
You know, I mean, I feel like it's the most mainstream play I've ever written, and it has like appeal with like sending it out after the production or during the production. Like I got more response than I've ever gotten to like sending plays out before. And so a lot of people were really excited about it, enthusiastic about it in a way that I hadn't experienced before. And so I think part of it is it has like a large appeal, and it's more relatable than some of my other things. And you know, it doesn't have any cursing in it, so that makes a difference. There's no overt sex in it.
Right.
It's not, you know, there's no...
Were those conscious choices?
I mean, it's a conscious choice now. I don't know if I definitely looked at, there was a while ago that I was like, oh, I love this like almost main kind of thing in which this can be done by like 18 people or like 4 people.
Mm-hmm.
But like the first play that I did that with is not a play that any high school would ever do. It's like, there's a lot of sex, there's violence and cursing, and like there's just like, it's just like a really intense, dark play.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked that idea of like, I love like people playing multiple parts and like that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is that play. Like, it can be done by 5 people. We did it with 7 in Portland. But it can be done with 5, and it can be done with, I think it's 16, might be 18. I don't remember offhand.
Mm.
But like in terms of like a high school doing it, like that totally makes sense.
Right.
And I feel like it's got stuff for them to do and all, like there's a lot of fun parts to play.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you only have like one of those 16 parts, like it's a fun part to play.
But when you were writing it, were you thinking in these terms that, oh, this will be easier, this will be more accessible?
I don't think so. It's hard, again, it's hard to remember because I wrote this in like 2013, 2014. So that's, you know, it's like 6 years ago and I write like 2-3 plays a year. So that's like, I've written, you know, whatever that
math
is,
yeah.
Whatever that math is, like 12 plays since then or
right.
something.
Yeah.
Wait, six, how many years?
Six years.
6 years, yeah.
Yeah, 5 or
so,
6 years.
Like, I might have written 12 or 18 plays since then. I probably, like, wrote, like, 16, 17 plays since then.
Right.
So it's hard to remember, like, what I was thinking when I wrote that play. I do know that that was one of the easier plays to write that I've written, which is weird. Because there isn't always a connection. Like, sometimes the play that's really hard to write is not a good play.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the play that's really easy to write is not a good play.
Mm-hmm.
This play, I feel like, is a really good play, and it came out really easily and really quickly in a way that I found surprising.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to jump back to pre-Juilliard. So you wrote Nerve, and you wrote Pretty Theft.
Mm-hmm.
And Pretty Theft is, you, I think, is what you said got you into Juilliard.
Yeah, I got into Juilliard Pretty Theft, yeah.
And I know these plays have been produced a lot. When did your productions start happening?
There was like a little production of Nerve, But basically in 2006, the summer after my first year at Juilliard, I had two plays off Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was the first thing I brought into Juilliard, which was a play called Food for Fish, which is it's a Chekhovian kind of, it's a crazy play.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot about gender, and it's a lot, it has like a lot, it's like directly like taking Chekhov quotes, and mm-hmm. like it's all like it's these three sisters, except that they're going, they want to go back to New Jersey instead of back to
Moscow.
Thank you. And so like it was Food for Fish happened, and then like 6 weeks later or a month later, Nerve happened, like right in a row, and they both got, the Times came to both of them, and they got really good reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly probably the Times came because I was at Juilliard at the time.
Yeah.
And Marcia gave me like a really good quote, like, I don't know, whatever. She said something really, I had like no press at all up to then. And so I was like, can you like say something? And she's like, yes. And it was like, she does that easily.
Yeah.
And so like on the strength of that, I think maybe we got someone to come. And that was back when like people would actually come from the Times to an off Broadway show that was running for like a month.
Yeah.
That no one knew anybody. And also like my friend Susan Louise O'Connor was a Nerve. And I think a lot of people, like a lot of press came because of her. And I think because they went to one and liked it, they came to the next and liked it.
Yeah.
And so I was able to get both of those published because the reviews were good, I think.
Yeah.
And because they went pretty well. And also Pretty Theft happened that summer in the DC Fringe. And I feel like there was like one other, we did it at Juilliard too, like that same, like that fall, I think.
Do you remember how it felt for this to happen? Were you like, hot damn, like,
yeah. I was like,
this shit's working for me.
Yeah. I was like, oh, my career. I have a career.
Yeah.
Like, what? I bet that's a 5-year-old.
This is a child trying to come in. Yeah.
What's up, buddy? Hold on a moment.
Yeah. Hey, Wallace.
Nothing.
So Brian and I are doing some stuff right now.
What sort of stuff?
We're doing an interview, so you need to go back upstairs to where Mommy is.
What's an interview?
I'll tell you, you go ask Mommy that right now. It might have worked.
That was cute.
We'll see.
Hopefully she gives him a very long explanation. And then plays him an episode of Fresh Air with Terry Gross.
Yeah. That sounds good.
Yeah.
I have no idea what I was saying.
So we're talking about these two plays happening off Broadway and
Right. Yeah, no, it was like, I was like, oh, I got good reviews. Like, and it was, you know, like the first review is terrifying. And so like getting that first good review was awesome. And then getting them published, like however much longer. And I just gotten, like I had this agent that I'd gotten because I interned for her. And she was really good at getting stuff published.
Mm-hmm.
She'd already gotten a play of mine published by a Dramatist Play Service.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like, oh, you like that one here, you're going to like these ones too. And it totally worked,
mm-hmm.
Which was pretty awesome. And then I didn't really have another production until like 4 years later, like another off Broadway. Which is, you know, for someone who writes three plays a year, like, you know,
you're like, what happened? I thought I had this career. I had these reviews.
Had two in a row. It was like everything.
Here it goes.
Yeah. And
I got to pay for this high rise apartment I have been eyeballing. Right.
Well, there was no, I mean, again, it was off Broadway. So there's no money. There was no, I mean, like there was like some money exchange hands, but not like, it was like $500 or
right.
something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Only because I had an agent negotiating it.
Right.
Yeah.
and whatever small amount.
Yeah, I mean for like the productions. So,
yeah, yeah.
And so then like, you know, that was like that year I had like four productions, and that was like amazing to me, like to have like four,
right.
Any kind of like finally like I'm getting like my plays done. You know?
Yeah, and so what I'm amazed by, I think I locked into you in after this dark period where these several years passed and nothing was happening, and then at the end of that is about the time that I learned who you were.
And it's not, and I'm saying it like that now, but that's not really the case. The real case is I had a bunch of really fancy readings and then nothing happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was like, oh my God, oh, South Coast Rep Commission. Reading at Labyrinth, like, you know, I was like in Ars Nova playgroup. I had like all these like super fancy things going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then like nothing, like no mm-hmm. one produced those plays based on like the super fancy readings
mm-hmm.
that
yeah.
seemed to, and like they seemed to go really well.
Yeah.
So I was like, why isn't this working?
Yeah.
Like, why isn't this happening? And then Flux Theater in 2009 did my play, Pretty Theft, which had been, you know, at this point I'd written it like 5 years before then, and they were the New York company that finally, I mean, that was, I think, the second production of it. Like
yeah.
Had this DC production, had this like workshop at Juilliard, and then that went really well. Got some more good reviews and got published. And
so now what I'm amazed by, and I don't mean that in any condescending way, if it sounds that way, like how is it possible that you know, admiring in an amazing way, how many productions you have of your work.
Oh yeah.
And so what I'm curious about is
a lot of it is hustle and a lot of it is having plays published.
Are they like picking a lot? Yeah, so these being
makes
picked
such
up
a through... huge difference.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are people find them because they're published. I've also kind of starting to take over the audition monologue scene
mm-hmm.
because a lot of my plays have auditions in. I mean, a lot of my plays have monologues in them.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, have this blog that has a lot of traffic. And I post like all the monologues of the published plays.
Mm-hmm.
And so like I sell more plays than I should because my monologues are online
mm-hmm.
in various places, but it started there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think some people find out about my plays from those too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, there must be some, you assume there's some like, I don't know. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't.
Well, I'm pointing people to your blog all the time from when they're looking for monologue material.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'll get an email, do you know anything, blah, 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 or do you have anything? And I'm like, I don't, but check Adam's blog because you're going to find something
yeah.
there.
Thanks.
When did the interview series begin?
So I had this blog. And I was in like the third wave of like theater bloggers.
Yeah.
So you know, Isaac was maybe in the first wave with like those people. And like all of my friends and all my now wife's friends like had blogs, and they mm-hmm. were all like posting regularly, and it was kind of like a live journal kind of era.
Yeah.
But there weren't a lot of people talking about theater at the time, and so there were maybe like 20 or 30 of us who were just talking to each other about theater. And this was pre-Facebook.
Yeah.
And so I had this blog, and I was talking about New York theater with other people somewhat, or like whatever. I wasn't very good at it. And then we moved to Minneapolis because my wife got a Jerome. And at the same time... around the same time, I was the Pretty Theft production,
mm-hmm.
and I got interviewed a few times for that. And I was like, "This is really fun."
Mm-hmm.
You know, Michael. Oh my God, how am I not able to remember how his name is spelled? Michael Criscolo. Anyway, that guy, he's awesome. but he was one of the people who interviewed me, but I had a few people interview me, and it was really cool. And yeah. I was like, maybe I should just like if I'm going to keep doing this blog, we're going to be in Minneapolis, so I can't keep talking about New York theater.
Right.
So maybe I'll like interview a few of my friends. And I'm the person who always at every party like finds the playwright at every theater party and talks to the playwright because I like playwrights.
Yeah.
And want to talk to playwrights. And so I was like, so I'll interview some playwrights. And I started doing that. And I just emailed some people that I knew, some people that I liked and wanted. And I was like, people like being interviewed. Why don't I try to do this?
Yeah.
And so I thought, you know, I'll do the, I don't know, maybe I'll do, maybe I can do like 50 or something.
Yeah.
Like maybe that's a thing that could happen. And then I didn't.
Did you have the same questions from interview one?
They're it's a little looser, like in the first few interviews. Mm-hmm. Some of them are more specific to the people, and I hadn't really figured out like what all the questions were.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, the one of the questions of like, tell me if you will, what you who you are, like based on your. How do I not know this question? I've seen this written.
Tell me
question.
A story from your childhood.
Yeah. Tell me, if you will, a story from your childhood who explains who you are as a writer or a person.
Yeah.
Like, that was a facetious... That was not supposed to be a serious one. I'm guessing I first did that to Matt Freeman.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, I'm going to fuck with Matt Freeman. but, like, that is... People write amazing things for that.
Yeah.
And so I'm so glad that I kept that and like continued to do that one.
Right. Well, it's now like a kind of an actor's studio, like James Lipton series of questions. Now it's like, how is this person going to answer the question about their childhood and the question about what advice would you give to a new playwright?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I realized at one point, you know, people were like, oh, you should make a book out of that. And I'm like, yeah. I mean, a book of that would be, you know, 2,000, 3,000 pages.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, maybe I can just do a book just of the...
advice.
And also I'd have to get like everyone's permission.
Right, sure.
So maybe I could do just a book of like all the advice.
Mm-hmm.
And that is also like, I cut and pasted it all. Or actually, I think I had an intern do it. Occasionally I have interns,
mm-hmm.
Who I pay like $10 to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have this huge document that, again, it's like incredibly long. Like,
mm-hmm.
yes, this could be a book, but like I haven't edited it and I haven't looked at it and to see like, or is everyone just saying the same thing or like how many worthwhile things are there here to say about mm-hmm. that? But yeah, there are amazing people who have amazing things to say. You know, I mean, like Paula Vogel, as you
right.
know.
Yeah.
She's an amazing human being.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like Chris Durang, like Adam Bock, like there's like a shocking number of amazing people.
And maybe you haven't, but I'm assuming you have realized that this series of interviews has become a thing.
So when I would start going to parties and people knew me because of my interviews instead of because of my plays, which was a little depressing. It's still a little depressing because I think I'm still more known for. But now it's different now because I'm like, oh, if they don't know who I am, then I think they don't know anything about theater. It's like, you don't know who I am? Do you not have the internet?
Well, there was, I was like number 200 and something on your list and, well, not list, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was the 200 and something person to be interviewed. And... it was like being seen for the first time.
Really?
It was 100% like I am now being seen for the thing I yearn to be. Because I was about 3 years into being a playwright or identifying as a playwright at all. And hadn't found really any success yet. Mm-hmm. But was just at it, was just writing and working at a theater and sending things around and getting tiny little things here and there, but I really hadn't found much. And a big part of what motivated me to get into the performing arts in the first place and eventually find playwriting was just the yearning to be heard and to be seen.
Yeah.
And a couple of my friends were interviewed. Callie Kimball was on there.
Callie.
And I was like, oh, wow. One day, like, I'm not kidding you. It was like, one day, I hope that happens. And I got an email, and I was like, this is amazing. It was like the most amazing thing in the world.
It's so crazy to hear that. And like, and I've heard people say that before. Like, people have said this kind of thing before.
Yeah.
And it's still crazy that I'm like, okay, I mean, it's just this thing. But like, you know, either people don't know what it is at all, or they're like, now I'm a real playwright. And
right.
I'm like, oh man, it is a weird thing where it's like, you know, there's no tangible way of success. And so, like, is it getting into the O'Neill? Is it, like, Juilliard, which was a huge thing for me.
Right.
And it's a huge thing for them now. Like, it's a gigantic, like, stamp of approval and of, like, you are a real writer kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so there's always, like, those things. And I feel like we kind of create them for ourselves, too. Whereas, like, I just wanted everyone to know how cool playwrights were.
And
it's like this other thing now of like another, you know, that people sometimes feel slighted and I don't even know it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when I have interactions with playwrights, you know, because there's over 1,000 now, I don't always remember if I've interviewed them or not.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
I mean, like, I know I interviewed you.
Yeah.
Like, but like there are a lot that I'm like, I don't, like, did I send them an email and they never responded?
Right,
did they
know
that
they
got, that they didn't ever respond? Did I never send that email? Like, I mean,
they mad at me because
I
haven't?
Are they mad at me? Yeah. I don't know. I'm super disorganized. So like, it's amazing that this thing is happening at all.
Yeah.
And so, like, there is, like, a certain amount of that. But I also feel like it's, like, I've acquired, a good amount of goodwill from doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Of, like, that people assume that I'm, like, generally a nice person. Because, like, I did this, because I'm doing this thing. And I do. I am interested in playwrights, and I do care about playwrights, and I care about the theater world. And, like, that's why I did it, but to begin with, that's the only reason to spend this much time and energy doing this thing.
When you got to like 1,000, you stopped for
about a year. What? I was like, and so that's another reason
you
that
just
like
think,
people might not know.
Did you just think, well, I hit a good round number, this is a good place to stop?
Yeah, I decided that I was gonna stop at 1,000. And I was like, I just can't, like, it's like too much energy. Sometimes I'm just not excited to do this anymore. It's become kind of a drag. I'm tired.
Yeah.
I'm tired. And like, I don't know if I want to, like, what's the purpose of this still? And I'm not being inspired as much as I used to be.
Yeah.
And like, all my heroes, like, either don't need this or like I've already talked to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, who would I even be excited about anymore?
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried to like talk to anyone who I hadn't talked to yet, who I was excited about. And you know, and like, that's when I like asked Paula Vogel again, and I don't think that you remember that I asked her the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Other people like that who I didn't actually know, who I reached out to
and
was like, I'm going to stop doing this. Like, any chance you'd like to do it before I stop doing it? And, you know, like with someone who's fancy, who's already super busy all the time.
Yeah.
Like, it's just another thing for them to do.
Yeah.
And so like, it's really helpful for people who are just starting out, for people who don't have a web presence, for people who, want to express what, like, who they are as an artist for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, it's not really for that other thing, except for people who are reading it, who are like, what does Chris Durang say about this thing?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So
why'd you pick it up again?
I mean, too many people told me I should keep doing it, and I missed it. I did miss it. Which means I don't know if I can ever stop doing it, which is a little depressing to me. But also, I feel more okay about taking breaks now. Of like if I haven't done it in a couple of weeks, like that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And the PR people, like, I told them all I was stopping doing it, and then I started doing it again. And mm-hmm. so they're all emailing me again.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, okay, all right, yes, I'll, like, someone's having a show, okay, I'll interview them.
Yeah.
I try really hard to keep, like, a certain amount of parity, and...
right, yeah.
And that's hard, because more men approach me, and fewer women are like... interview me, and more men are like, interview me,
and that speaks to the
and
problem,
the more the
right?
PR yeah. people have more men than women, like almost always.
Yeah.
And so it's like a, you know what? This just reminded me that I want to go. I need to look at the Kilroy's list and see who I haven't interviewed yet, who's on that list this year.
But then cross reference the subtext and see who hasn't been included.
Oh, to tell you?
No. Okay. So like, cross-reference my list and see. We should keep in touch.
Oh, yeah,
who
yeah.
We're interviewing.
I should totally.
Yeah.
Because I don't think I saw Kristen. Well, actually, I don't know. Isn't that terrible? I really don't know. I cannot keep 1,000 names in my head.
Yeah.
You have to go to your... I've hit my limit on Facebook like a long time ago. So I have 5,000 friends, and I have 2,000 other people who are following me. I have like somewhere similar to that number on Twitter. I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
But like, there's like, I can't remember who all those people are, and probably most of them are playwrights.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, like, there's what, 6,000 playwrights on
New
Play Exchange.
Yeah.
Yeah. And probably like 10,000 to 15,000 overall. So
that's a lot.
But if I do it at 100 a year, there's no way I'll ever get them all. So
true,
it's fine.
Can you tell me a story from your childhood?
I definitely answered that question because I was number 100. Because
right,
thought
I know.
Stop at 100.
I read it. Yeah.
And probably the answer I'm going to give is that answer, which is. I was in a lot of plays, starting in kindergarten, and in kindergarten I had this amazing teacher, Elizabeth Beauchesne, who like had us as a class write a play together, which of course, I mean, she was the mastermind behind it, but like we all had created characters and we're using alliteration, I don't know. And this was like an enrichment class that I was in, that I would go for a certain number of hours every day or every week or something. I'm not really sure.
Mm-hmm.
But like every year we would have a play that we would be in. And like, that was my introduction to theater, is like being the guy named Whoop. That was my character's name, Whoop, who like stole the magic potions because he wanted to have friends, and it was amazing.
It sounds
like,
amazing.
I was like the bad guy in it.
Yeah.
Who like was just misunderstood. and like I was that first grade or kindergarten? I'm not sure, but I was like a little kid.
Yeah.
Like doing, like we all memorized lines and did this show, and I was in at least a play a year all through high school. Like multiple plays a year during high school. And so I think that I really think about theater from the perspective of like an actor in it. Like partially I am in theory writing this play for audiences,
mm-hmm.
but really I'm more excited about the actors who are playing these parts each time. Like I'm think about them more than I think about like the audience who's seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm thinking like, is this going to be a fun thing to do? Is this like a good part? Is this like a thing that you want on the stage for someone to do? So probably I said something like that.
Yeah. But so you mentioned before earlier about, you know, maybe one day you'll publish, you know, some version of this or excerpts from it or whatever.
Yeah.
And it made me think about how, you know, a lot of these interviews were done, like yours was done number 100, and that was almost a decade ago.
Yeah, those people are completely different now.
Yeah, like your answers are very different. I know if I was asked the same questions today, perhaps my childhood question might be similar because that event still has happened.
That's still the thing.
But the advice question, I think, is an evolving thing as our careers change and the American theater community changes.
I just realized that I should ask about success. I feel like that's a question that I want different people to answer. I don't know if that would be satisfying, but I feel like asking, like, what is success to you? What is your version of success? Because for me, it's always like, oh, it's this thing. Like I was saying before, you know, like New Dramatists or like the O'Neill, or like there are like benchmarks that some people, the very lucky, sometimes get an off-Broadway show, a Broadway show, like whatever the thing is. But it's like once you get that thing, then you've gotten that thing.
And right.
Then, like, did it go well? Did it not go well? Like, what did you get out of it? Is it, and then you have to go on with your life.
It's a moving and evolving target.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. And so there's not, and so I could, you know, I don't know. I mean, right now I'm super proud that I have like 14 published plays. Like, mm-hmm. I'm so proud that I have these 14 published plays. I've never had an off-Broadway production. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I ever will, because I feel like the more the kinds of plays I'm writing are moving further and further away from the kinds of plays that I see off-Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of more, as time goes on, they're coming more regional. And I don't know if that's because I have a kid now and, like, my life is different and, like, I'm kind of more, I'm gentler or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Or if that's always the way I should have been writing, or I don't know. But it's also it seems like there's a lot fewer opportunities for off-Broadway productions than there were when I was coming up.
So is your definition of success or the way you see success for yourself different now than it was a decade ago?
I don't know. I mean, I guess that's why I want to ask that question to other people, because I don't quite know that I have a good answer that I'm happy with.
Mm-hmm.
Of like, I wish I knew what to say because like I feel like it's very easy to be like I'm super successful or like I'm real super unsuccessful, and if you ask me on any given day I can mm-hmm. tell you that I'm not successful or successful based on how I'm feeling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I feel like that's not helpful to be like, oh, I'm so depressed, like no one's ever gonna do a play of mine again.
Right.
Which like is totally a way I felt like last year, you know. You know, like right around this time, like I was like, oh, I posted that on Facebook.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I just had a production, like no one will ever do another play of mine again, like my career is over, like what am I even doing?
Right.
Like, it's hard, like if you don't have something to look forward to, if you don't, there's so few big deal slots, there's so few slots and like development slots, there's so few slots like everywhere that like we're all vying for.
Mm-hmm.
That it's like, it's really easy to be like, well, if I'm always getting rejected from everything, then I've failed and I'm a failure. Whereas like you can write really beautiful plays year after year after year, and if you don't show them to enough people and enough theaters, they will never get done and no one will ever know about them.
Mm-hmm.
Like I feel like most of my success comes from my initial hustle. And then after that, it's like the other people that take over and am able to like build kind of a certain amount of momentum.
Right. And ride
but
that. Yeah.
Like I still am having to hustle as much as I was back then and part of it is because I do write 3 plays a year,
mm-hmm.
you know, like no one,
do you see a difference between success and satisfaction? Can you be satisfied?
I don't know if I can. And if I was, would I stop writing? Because I'd be like, oh, I wrote the perfect play. Great. Why bother writing another one?
Is there a fear that if you judge yourself, and I mean this in a general sense, maybe not specifically you, Adam, but mm-hmm. if we judge ourselves as successful, that's an end point?
I mean, I think there's some truth to that. I feel like there's some kind of, it's easy to see these goalposts as endpoints, mm-hmm. where really they're just part of the path.
Right.
And I don't know how to look at it another way. Like, I'm just like, oh, I really want that big regional production. And I got the big regional production. And it didn't change my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I got, you know, that New York Times review, and it didn't change my life. Everything went back to, you know, some version of the way it was before.
Mm-hmm.
Like, right now, I really wish I could figure out a way to make a living as a playwright.
Mm-hmm.
And that feels really far. And it feels really far to get an off-Broadway production. So I don't know. Those are things that I really want. But I think I can be successful without those things. Like, definitely the number of productions I'm having this year is more than the number of productions I had last year, which is more than the productions I had. You know, it goes, like, up and down a little mm-hmm. bit. But, like, I'm definitely going to have more productions this year than I've ever had before.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is a true thing that's happening.
Mm.
I've not gotten a lot of press this year, and that's a weird difference. And I think it's partially like doing shows out of town,
right?
Instead of New York, where all the media centers. But also, like, maybe I'm just thinking about all this stuff way too much. You know, like, really, like, all that matters is like writing good plays and like trying to get people to see them.
Yeah, yeah, but you can't put anybody. Nobody can put a definition of success on another person. It is all self-identifying. Like, what you think.
Oh, I can't tell you how many people that I'm like, oh my God, this person is so successful. They have no idea how great they're doing. And also it has no relation to happiness.
Like, right.
So many people are miserable who, in my mind, are doing incredibly well. And some people are happy who are not doing very well at all.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing is, yeah, like judging other people based on that is not helpful to anyone.
Right.
So, yeah, so that's maybe a question I should ask everybody.
The way I see it is we're all on a continuum.
Yeah.
And there's always something else to reach for.
Yeah.
And every year when the Pulitzers get announced, Pulitzer, how do you say
Pulitzer.
That?
I used to work at Columbia, and
it's definitely
pronounced Pulitzer.
Every time the Pulitzers get announced, there are people who are mad that they didn't get it.
Yeah.
You know? And that actually brings me comfort. When the Pulitzer for drama comes out, I'm like, right now there are a couple playwrights who are like, son of a bitch.
Yeah. I really think about that year that Lisa Crone and Madeline were both up for the Pulitzer and both didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine them, I mean, they're married, and I imagine them both, like, you know, comforting each other
mm-hmm.
and saying how great the other's play was, and because they're both such wonderful people. And so it's like, I imagine that's what happened. And now I've forgotten who actually won that year.
Yeah.
because the narrative that I'm most interested are the two people who were second place.
Yeah.
Who were both these amazing playwrights. Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to look up.
Yeah.
I don't remember what year that was. Maybe it was Annie Baker. That was a really good play.
Well, anyway. Plugs?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm having some plays coming up, but people should just, I guess, look at my blog to see. I can't name them all right now, and I don't know. I have like five or six things happening this month in various places in the country.
Yeah.
What I'm excited about is that I'm about to go to Nashville like later this month,
uh-huh.
which I've never been to Nashville before. I've had like five productions there, which is unheard of for a city.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had a lot in LA and I've had a lot in New York, but like apart from that, like there's not a lot of, and so for some reason I've had, and this is the third one that this particular theater has done of mine.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really excited to see them and to meet the Nashville theater scene and to like check out a new city. And I mean, that's one of the most fun things about being a playwright is to like be able to go somewhere you haven't before and to like run into you in Portland, like randomly, like just be like, oh hey, we're in the same city, like, and that happens. Like I go to the theater in a strange city, and I almost always see someone I know who also doesn't live in that city,
right?
Who is there seeing a play
to work on a
which
thing,
which is so which is just so cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad I got to come here.
Yeah.
And
we can go
see your home.
We can go do a. We can go boating right now.
Yeah, we can go outside and play in the water.
I think my one of my sisters just showed up.
Yeah,
I'm sure. I heard someone say hello.
Yeah.
So
it's a good time to wrap up.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for giving me a little bit of time.
Thanks.
Right on.
I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Adam and Wallace. We did indeed go kayaking after we recorded this, and it was the exact amount of relaxation I needed after leaving New York City and before heading north to see my own family up in New Hampshire. Adam has a lot of fantastic plays available from Samuel French, Dramatist Play Service, Play Scripts, Original Works Publishing, and others. Go give a read to his plays. You can also find him on New Play Exchange, and when one of his plays is being produced where you live, go see it. The music for the opening of this episode is from The Joyful String Band. The music you hear right now is from Jan Tirian. The theme song for the subtext is Hi by International Pen Pal. Thank you to American Theater Magazine, a publication of Theater Communications Group, and thank you for listening. The play filling me up this month is The Living Life of the Daughter Mira by Matthew Paul Olmos. I read this play several years ago, and I have not stopped thinking about it since. It's just so good, and I don't understand why it hasn't been produced 1,000 times by now.